listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Tonight's episode, Play Choice 10. This episode is sponsored by Red Giant Software, makers of kick-ass plugins for post-production. Did you see the Polygon review of the PS4 and the Xbox One, or
AKA I did the X-Bone? at your recommendation, and yes. And you described it to me as a thing of HTML5 glory, and it totally is.
Oh yeah, I think the actual words I used was it was HTML5 sex.
That works too.
Yes.
I love the way they did it with the split. There's no way to describe this thing on air, but I love the way they did the split.
Oh, yeah. Well, they just took the entire thing over, which is really fantastic.
Because
yeah.
Really, what else were they going to be talking about?
Yeah, really. I mean, come on. It's only the biggest thing to happen in, well, the last, oh, I don't know, 7 years or so. But I like the Vox Media properties because they tend to do really cool things with their long-form editorials. I've mentioned The Verge a jillion times on the podcast, and I like them a lot. And they do, you know, they always change up their long-form layouts and such to make them really interesting. And I'm actually wondering how they do that. Like, what part of their CMS allows them to completely fuck with their CSS for one-offs?
Either they've homegrown something, or my gut is that they have people like, you know, back in the day, like my ex used to do, who are like, they're web programmers, like, we're going to do this, so start coding that, and it's going to be this thing, and we're going to pop it in, you know, I don't know. It's so different from everything else. It's got to be one-offs.
Right. Well, it's interesting because it's one of the things that we're going to do at the office, where we're trying to redo imaginaryforces.com. It's been that way for a while. And one of the things that we want to do is have these little mini sites for behind the scenes. So certain projects that are really big projects for us that we want to showcase, we're going to have these little one-offs. And we're struggling to find a technology, an off-the-shelf technology, that will actually allow us to do that, give us the flexibility to do that, but then also have like a standardized format for other things as well. So the reality of the situation is that we're probably going to create our own CMS in order to do that. And so that's going to be a bit of an arduous task. And I'm not particularly looking forward to it, but I am looking forward to being able to do these really story-like, cinematic HTML experiences for our big projects. So that should be really cool. So yeah, so Polygon and The Verge have done some really, really great stuff here. They divided their website into PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, and you just choose one and then go through it. And it does a lot of SVG stuff. There's a lot of interactive elements going down, and it's a very nice long-form review of the two boxes. But spoiler alert, at the moment, A, they're both impossible to find. So if you want a PlayStation 4, you're going to be shelling out $1,000 for one on Amazon, you know, secondary market. But B, it seemed to me that the launch titles for both of them, with the exception of possibly Forza on Xbox One, the launch titles are really weak on both platforms.
Well, there's the pirate game, whatever that is, on PS4. On PS4, I mean, what is it?
Assassin's Creed Pirate Edition?
Yeah. Apparently that's there. Yeah, it's doing fairly strong, I guess.
Right. But I mean, it's strong in a fairly weak environment, though. Mm. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's got any competition, really, which is a little bit unfortunate. It seems to me that both of these boxes are ostensibly PCs. They're both running Intel chips, and they're both running GPUs that are slightly tweaked for the console, but they're what I'd call modern GPUs. They're both from AMD, you know, so they're not, obviously they're not CUDA-powered, but they conform to modern GPU specifications.
Yeah.
So you'd think that there would be at least some PC games that got ported fairly quickly, but it seems that a lot of them are PS3 versions or Xbox 360 versions that maybe with a little bit of extras, or in some cases fewer options or capabilities, which struck me as very strange.
I guess if you look at them both, they really only had, you know, one major launch title, which I guess, yeah, it's kind of weird. But for both of them, well, I'm actually more surprised at Microsoft than I am at Sony, because you know how Sony is. They'll just do weird things that, you know, that won't seem to make much sense. Whereas I really expected Microsoft to have, you know, more, you know, of the hot launch titles, you know. Or
right. Well, it seems, from my perspective anyway, and this is just anecdotal evidence, but it seemed to me a lot of friends I have preferred the Xbox 360 over the PS3. They seem to have better titles and just generally more of them. And the first-party titles were more interesting. I mean, obviously, there are a lot of Halo fans and such. So I expect the Xbox One to be sort of more popular, at least in the short term. I mean, obviously, it's a long game, right? So,
yeah.
You know, the launch kind of doesn't mean too much. I don't think that you can really judge a console by its launch. I mean, other than there's so much hype and this particular gaming cycle has been so long, it's been like 7 odd years or so, that everyone was dying for a new console. So everyone is going to sell out for the time being. You know, if you want to get one for Christmas, good luck.
It's not as segmented as the, you know, Nintendo versus everyone else kind of thing. But the two machines have always been like split as far as with their audience. You know, it's like I am more of a PS3 player than I had an Xbox. I never played it, so I sold it. But clearly there's a, you know, this huge market for Xbox. And I don't know another way to put it, but, you know, there are a lot of guys who play Xbox, you know, and there's a lot of, I mean, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't girls who play Xbox too, but there's this, seems to be this, you know, you remember how it was with Sega?
Mm-hmm.
All the guys had Segas because they were playing hockey and they were playing, you know, this and that. So it's kind of like that, but, you know, more first-person shooter. I mean, again, I don't want to make this a gender thing because, you know, there are a lot of women that play MMOs and stuff like that. But there are so many first-person shooters for Xbox, and they're done so well on the Xbox. You know, in general, first-person shooters tends to pull more guys or what you would call hardcore gamers, I guess is what I'm really getting at.
Right.
Whereas the PS3 has a broader range of titles that, you know, there are some of those games on there, but there are also, you know, the wider audience games. Top of my head, I'm failing to pick on them.
Well, there are certainly a lot more. It seems to me that the PS3 and actually the PlayStation lineup in general, along with the Nintendo lineup, they've always been much more broad in their offerings. So, for example, where the Xbox is, like, you see a lot of sports games being really popular. I mean, obviously, sports games are popular full stop, but they seem to be more popular on the Xbox than on PlayStation or on Nintendo Wii, as right. Well as you mentioned, like first-person shooters. And then that could be part of the Halo effect, as it were, right?
Well, and there's also the whole thing with Sony and Nintendo. They both have an idea who they want to be. And Sony loves things like Little Big Planet. But they, you know, they also love Assassin's Creed or whatever. Which, like, if you look at Little Big Planet, that's totally not an Xbox title.
Yeah, you'd never see something like that on Xbox because it's not the personality. And I wonder if the Xbox being an American system is fundamentally different from the Japanese system in that regard. Like, I don't see,
or at least in the companies that put the vision or the idea behind it, you know, where they push where it wants to go.
Right, where I don't think I would ever see a dating simulator on Xbox. You know,
whereas, not one that you'd want to participate in anyway.
Right, certainly not. I mean, not unless you count, you know, Grand Theft Auto as a dating sim.
I don't think that's the right word for what that happens. Dating is not what that is.
No.
But, you know, and I don't want to people to think I'm dissing Xbox gamers or the Xbox itself. It's a great platform. It's one of Microsoft's best moves ever. It's amazing that this thing comes from Microsoft to start with, but
well, they did the classic Microsoft thing, right? Which was put out a really shitty product once and then keep it alive because it can be subsidized by Office and Windows operating system, and then make another one that's better, that learned from the first, and now we're on the third incarnation, and it's possibly the best yet.
Yeah, but even the first one was, I mean, it certainly wasn't a failure. It attracted all of that audience for the second one. I mean, the number of people I know who had the original Xbox, I know numerous people, and they, some of them still have it, you know? Mm. It wasn't a great piece of hardware, but it certainly was a market that, and a new game market and segment that they totally grew out of nowhere. And another part of that is very Microsoft too. It's like, well, we have this thing, we want to do this thing, but you guys just go over there and do that thing and good luck. Turned out that those guys were really good at it, and they made something interesting.
Yeah, I think there are several things going on there. I like the idea that the Xbox team, whoever they are when they first started it, were able to successfully ban the word Windows from box. Because you also have to remember that back in the day, it was the Dreamcast that actually had a Windows CE environment mm-hmm. that it could boot into.
that no one used.
Yeah, that no one used at all, but it was there nonetheless. Yeah. And so that was kind of their first foray into the console market. And they said, screw this, we can actually do one better. And they did. You know, it was ostensibly a PC in a box like the X-Bone.
Yeah, I've never thought of it that way. But yeah, the Xbox killed that machine.
Yeah.
And what a great machine it was. The Dreamcast, I mean.
Yeah, no, the Dreamcast had a lot of really great stuff going on. You know, it was very proprietary with regard to its chipset and its graphics and all that sort of thing. But that was still in the time where, you know, all consoles were super hyper proprietary and they kind of designed their own chips and all that. And even Sony, you know, carried that forward with their cell processor and the Emotion Engine and all that fun stuff. And now they all kind of said, you know what, screw it. We're just going to go with off-the-shelf PC hardware and see how that works.
Well, yeah, and in a way, there's, you know, when you're building a game machine, you're doing something very different. You know, you need to keep costs low, but you need to have a high vector performance, and you need to have high memory bandwidth, and you need to have, you know, these things that aren't so important on PCs.
Well, I think I think what happened was the consumer level general purpose CPU
has now come to something.
Right, exactly. It now has all that stuff built into it. It's got high memory bandwidth. It's got vector processing. It's got a lot of registers so that you can, you know, have a lot of instructions in flight at once. You know, we're finally at a level, and much like the desktop computing level, where a lot of, you know, most quote normals don't need to have anything much faster than what they've got because it's already always waiting for them. The people, you know, operating the machine are never waiting for it, you know, unless it's a bandwidth thing or what have you, but it's usually not a CPU problem.
Right. And, you know, and we've got all this GPU history behind us now from both the PC gaming and from the professional market that, you know, the GPUs, even the GPUs, which aren't the high end, are more than adequate to run a gaming system, you know.
Right. And so this is why I think the Xbox this round is actually far more interesting than the PlayStation 4. To me, the PlayStation 4 just seems to me like a version of the PlayStation 3 that's better. It's got more RAM, it's got, you know, it's faster CPU, it's a faster GPU. Yes, it's a different architecture, but it's basically the same thing, and it's marketed to be another gaming console. Just like you can draw somewhat of a parallel between the Nintendo Wii and the Wii U. The Wii U is ostensibly a faster version of the Nintendo Wii, whereas the Xbox One is meant to be something different in another way, very similar to the original Wii, which is it's trying to appeal and to a different audience. It's trying to do something slightly different by being a part of your home entertainment center with all of its, you know, television aspect and all the online components as well.
Yeah, I would probably, I don't know. I disagree maybe with the saying the Wii U is just a better Wii. I think maybe the Wii was a better GameCube.
Right, which it also was. I mean, it was just a higher clocked version of the same chip, if I recall correctly.
But the Wii U, I mean, it does go out on a limb, you know. It's like, here's a controller with a big LCD, you know, and we're going to actually use it as part of the gaming. So I don't know. Might have to disagree there.
Well, I think, you know, okay, I get where you're coming from.
But your general premise is yes, I agree. I mean, the PS4 is nice, and I want one because I'm more of a PlayStation person, but it is like a PS3 Plus or something.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, is catering to its core demographic, which is the, quote, you know, hardcore gamer. Because you figure all the casual gaming folk are really just on their phones. You know, they're downloading stuff from the app, from the App Store,
or they have a Wii U.
Yeah. Do people actually have Wii U's? Is that a thing that people bought?
Sure. I mean,
aside from John Syracuse.
Not in the numbers that, you know, the PS3 and Xbox 360, but I mean, it sold reasonably well.
Interesting, because I haven't seen numbers anytime recently, and I just remember the launch being very sad.
Yeah, it's always been a very family-oriented system, you know, from day one. So it's not the sort of thing that you see bandied about in the, you know, the gaming sites and whatnot, because, you know, there's a lot of kids playing it. And, you know, we don't report on kids anymore.
Well, I also found interesting, though, is that gaming has become, through some parameter, a mainstream hobby. Right?
Absolutely. So, it's totally mainstream.
You know, and I think that's great. You know, it was all the kids who are now, you know, who were born in the 80s who had Nintendos growing up and they had Super Nintendos growing up. And so now that they're in their 30s or what have you, they continue to game, which is wonderful. But that also means that you see advertising for games themselves and for the systems, for the platforms. And I see a huge amount of marketing for EA games, for some first-party games for Xbox, and some first-party games for PlayStation. But I never, ever, ever see a Nintendo advertisement.
I do, because I watch a lot of Cartoon Network.
Ah! Therein lies the game. Because right. And maybe that is. That's the demographic that they're after, and therefore they advertise only there. But yeah, I see Xbox and PlayStation adverts all the time on
that
AMC.
Perfect Day.
And even Comedy Central, right?
Yeah. That Perfect Day, PS4 Perfect Day ad has been played so many times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And yeah, gets a little tedious, actually.
A little bit.
Just a wee. Not to be confused with the Wii U.
Right.
Entirely different.
And now there's a Wii Mini. Have you seen that?
What? Oh, that's the thing that was only... Yeah, it's actually the original Wii, but smaller. And I believe, if I recall correctly, it doesn't have any of the online components.
No, it has no networking.
The fucking fuck?
But I thought that at first, and then I'm like, you know, when we first had our Wii, we never used it online. The only time we started using online was when we got the little Netflix disc. So, meh. I can kind of see it in a way. I mean, this is something you buy and you put in your kid's bedroom, you know. It's not to go, it doesn't go in the living room because then you probably want to do stuff. But it's an interesting box. It's $100.
That's not so bad. But I remember buying the Wii on launch day for the office at Behavior. And I remember plugging it in and it demanding going online to download a patch.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. I don't know how this particular thing deals with that. So
I think actually it's probably just, you know, it's old technology. It's been patched enough, so it's probably done.
Yeah, you can probably just leave it like it is forever.
Because, yeah. I mean, you never had, you know, your original Nintendo never had patches. Your Super Nintendo never had patches.
Right, and there probably won't be enough new titles to call for changes in the firmware, so.
Right. So yeah, this is an interesting era for the console. I'm looking forward to it. I think we'll really know how the platforms, you know, net out in about a year or two when people start actually coding directly for the new hardware versus trying to port old stuff.
Because these two, we may talk about them as being, you know, just an iteration, where I guess the Xbox really isn't an iteration, but it's more of a newer thing. But both of them, integrate things that they, you know, experimented with, you know, the whole virtual space stuff. And mm-hmm. so, but these are the first two consoles that were built with that in mind. So that's going to make me.
That's the irony, right? Because the Xbox ships with the Kinect 2. It inbox, you do not have the option of right. not getting it. And consequently, it's $100 more than the PlayStation. But the PlayStation originally was meant to ship with the new Move, and it was decoupled at the last moment.
Move.
Yeah. So what I would like to know is who in the nine hells is going to bother to create games for the Move when no one is going to buy that shit?
Well, I don't know. You know, they bought Kinects and they bought Moves, and although Move less so.
No one bought a Move.
Well, as I said, less so.
Yeah. I also find it really amusing, though, that the controllers still have that vestigial light on them from when they were packing in the camera.
You mean on the front of the controller?
Right. On the PS4, yeah. The PS4 controller.
I've heard some positive things about that, like things like it changing color to show the, you know, who's the first controller.
Well, that's pretty cool, but you can do that with an LED like they did with the original PlayStation 3 controller.
Right, but I mean, but no, but other people can see.
Oh, I see. But yeah. But everyone is facing the screen and you can't see the color from where you're sitting because it's facing away from you.
Well, and it can work with the Move system.
Right.
And that it can track things now.
Well, that was the whole point of it. It was meant to replace the ice cream cone things that, from the PlayStation 3 Move concept, which I just thought was like, this is how not to do this technology.
I know.
It just seems so clunky and so poorly thought out. When you had, you know, when you had the Wii and, you know, you have the magic wand and it's all there and it tracks everything and it's got the gyro built in and it looks super groovy, you know, and then you've got the Xbox and you've got Kinect, which is clearly like an evolution where you don't even need a wand. It'll just follow you and that's really cool.
Well, and yeah, then, of course, at the time everyone was going, how the fuck did they do that?
Well, yeah, there's that. But then, you know, Sony comes out with this Move thing, and you've got these giant glow-in-the-dark ice cream cones, and it's like, really? That was your solution to the problem? Couldn't you have thought this out just a little bit longer?
It reminds me of the Aibos. The robot dog, had a ball. You know, it was either blue or it was orange, and they could follow it around.
Oh, but only because it was blue or orange.
Right.
Oh.
So when I first thought it, I'm like, oh, great. It's Aibo's new ball.
Yes. You're a human Aibo.
Yeah. I'm like, great. This is the best technology they have, I guess.
Oh, dear. Yeah, no. Dear Sony. Try spraying the room with IR and seeing what happens. Use two cameras. Oh, my. It's all very, very unfortunate. But I'm really psyched for the new Kinect 2. I think it does a lot of really cool stuff. It's a little bit creepy in that it is so sensitive that it can actually track your heartbeat. So that's kind of cool.
And there's the it's always on thing.
Well, yeah, the always on thing. I don't know how always on it really is anymore.
I just meant as far as creep factor goes.
Right. Well, yes. I mean, that always on is always creepy, full stop.
I don't think you should be watching that, Dave.
But I think they did something to where it's not actually as on as it once was. I think it's basically shut off save one tiny thing that tries to pattern match a particular phrase or something like that.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, which makes sense. Like if you want it to be voice activated, well, it needs to be listening.
Right. There needs to be some sort of like partial sleep mode, you know, catnap mode where it's, you know, it's got one eye open, you know, that type of thing. But yeah, well, the original napping mode was that it was just ostensibly fully on all the time, possibly recording all the time, possibly listening all the time, possibly giving all of your information to the NSA, etc.
I was going to say, are we talking about the NSA or the Xbox?
Yes. And if you think they are actually different things, I've got something to tell you.
No,
not really. No, nothing you don't already know.
Move along, sigh. Move along.
Yes, nothing to see here. Please put on your tinfoil hat. So, fair warning, I don't have either console, but I think they're pretty cool. I will probably... I'm leaning toward the Xbox, to be honest. I think that the Xbox ecosystem seems a little bit more my speed. The social aspects, getting together with other gamers, and I know I've got a bunch of friends who also have Xbox. And yes, they play a lot of first-person shooters, a lot of, you know, Call of Duty and all that sort of stuff. You know, I like the idea of the television aspects as well, although I hear that they're not particularly great. So I don't have my hopes up for that.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't really care about that stuff. I mean, I know some people will. I think especially, and it's just maybe I've only think this because of the commercials, but I can totally see sports people. People are really into sports, maybe using it.
Right.
So like literally, like the commercial where they're playing and they're literally watching a game at the same time. You know, okay, fine. But I don't think most people want their TV to invade their gaming in general.
Well, you also own a DVR and specifically a TiVo, or at least you had a TiVo at one point in time. And so you have a lot of the really nice on-screen scheduling and DVRing.
Right. I mean, and, you know, of course, this thing isn't, it's not a tuner. You know,
right.
So it takes an input. So
yeah, and that's the other thing too, is that it's technically taking an input. It's just shy of being an IR blaster, right?
So right. It's picture in picture.
Yeah, I mean, that's the downside.
Mostly.
So the Xbox has an HDMI in and an HDMI out. So the out obviously goes to the television. The in should theoretically go from your cable box, but I think someone actually plugged another Xbox into the Xbox.
Yeah, they said it was kind of laggy though. So
oh, not at all surprising. But the idea of infinite Xbox is kind of intriguing.
It's Xboxes all the way down.
Yes, it is. But I like the idea of having a single point of entry into my, you know, entertainment center. You know, whether it's turn on Comedy Central or turn on Assassin's Creed, that's a really compelling thing for me if they can pull it off, which...
Yeah, and I guess I really haven't looked into the degree of... I mean, I've seen the commercials and, I don't know how...
Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, right.
I think that's the giant caveat to that, you know?
Right, because playing a movie is one thing, because it can get it from somewhere, but, you know, like TV, that's where it kind of gets a little squishy.
And TV, of course, is the holy grail. You know, Apple has been rumored to be working on this particular problem, and everyone's working on this particular problem because this problem is particularly hard and it sucks a great deal. It's a giant hurt that everyone has. You know, the cable boxes are horrendously bad, and yet they can't be upgraded because there are so many cable boxes out in so many different areas that if you try to upgrade everyone's cable box, you know, yes, the cable companies could upgrade the cable box. The problem, though, is that the infrastructure that goes to that cable box in a lot of areas is Byzantine. And it's not cost effective for the cable companies to roll out fiber to everyone in rural Arkansas. You know, it's just not going to happen. And so, therefore, everyone is stuck with the lowest common denominator. And that's really depressing.
Right. And then they'll move, you know, new things out slowly, like the Comcast DVR versus the Comcast TiVo DVR. The penetration, it moves very, very slowly. So, yeah, it's not going to be something that you can just bloop. Well, not until cable itself is no more, when it's not cable anymore, where it's, you know.
And isn't it going to be ironic when you have the major telcos saying, hey, this LTE thing and this 5G thing coming down the pipe, that's all going to be wireless and it's going to be faster than most people's cable modems. So why are we dealing with cable television at all when everyone knows, and even the cable companies agree, that the future is television over IP. Like, that's a thing that everyone knows.
Right, and where would be a great place to put all that? What about the it's game console, you know?
Exactly. I could certainly see that, but of course not everyone is going to have a game console. The smarts can certainly be built into televisions these days.
Right.
But it's going to be really interesting when, you know, for example, I have Cablevision, and I've got a fairly fast pipe to the internet using Cablevision's Optimum Online service, and it's all very well and good. I don't have the top tier of it, but the tier I've got is fairly okay. However, the LTE that is on both my iPhone and my Android phone, my Android development phone, spank it. Like, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous that I can get both down and up literally twice or more than my cable internet access. And if I can do that, that means that I can basically stream television at high definition resolution at H.265, which of course is the new standard coming out, which is going to be very, very efficient. Why am I not doing that tomorrow?
Right. And we've already seen a little microcosm of this shuffling around where, you know, it's like we see the smart TVs. Oh, it does Netflix and it does Pandora. And your Roku does Amazon and Hulu and haha. It's like the larger picture being that one day we'll do them all like that. But yeah. They'll settle somewhere. I don't, you know, they'll probably settle to the TVs and then they'll probably settle into, as you know, game consoles as well. We'll compete. Hey, we can do that stuff too. And you can play your games and yada yada.
Well, everything, I certainly see everything being on demand. We're going to be fast enough that, you know, we could download, much like today's Blizzard titles, right? So if you buy World of Warcraft, or if you buy, you know, any of the modern titles, Diablo 3, etc.
Just Dance 2014.
Yeah. If you buy one of these titles and you buy them electronically so they're downloading, you don't have to wait to play it. You download, you know, the core bits, and that's maybe about, like, oh, I don't know, 2 minutes or so. And on my connection, it's about 2 minutes of wait time. And then you can start playing right then and there. It'll continue to download stuff in the background, but it's exactly like a progressive video where you can start watching it now. And as long as you don't get too far, you're good to go.
Yeah, or you'll see things like, you know, you'll pre-order the next Call of Duty and it'll come out overnight and you'll wake, you know, the next morning, oh, I have the new Call of Duty. You know?
Right. It'll just be there and yeah, you'll have some local storage and that'll be fine. But in general, you'll just be able to call it up on demand like you would any other video or anything like that. So I think the consoles are pretty cool. I think they're both viable. I think they'll be more interesting in a year or two.
Neither one of them is bad, you know. Neither one of them is like the, oh, that's unfortunate console.
Yeah, well, it's funny. While I'm certainly leaning toward the Xbox as a console I'll probably own, there are so many first-party titles for the PlayStation that make me say, yes, I should buy a PlayStation. The Little Big Planet franchise being one of them, Gran Turismo being another, although Forza's a nice alternative. There's also the Ico and Shadows of Colossus team. Those guys are absolutely amazing, and I will buy anything they make.
And Knack, which I know some people have been soft or hard on, been able to look at it, but it does look really interesting.
Knack, I've not heard of it.
It's an exclusive title, and it's a different sort of game. Very different sort of game.
Like, do I need an adult kind of game, or so not a first-person shooter then?
Well, it's very much a PlayStation 3 game. I mean, it has some aspects of gaming, like, you know, first-person shooters or whatever. It's a combat game, but the protagonist is different. The protagonist is made of things, and you can change and grow. It's really very interesting. I don't know how to describe it.
Interesting. I'll check it out. That's kind of cool. The idea of it, you have different abilities and you can do different things throughout the game.
Yeah, it's literally made of pieces of things, and so it can be very small or it can be enormous.
So you are basically the Katamari in this game.
Yes, there is some very Katamari aspects to this character.
And that's another game, Katamari Damacy, which you will never find on Xbox.
That's totally not an Xbox game. It's like some things do cross over, you know. They're like I joked about Just Dance 2014, but like Dance Dance Revolution and things like that.
Those do
cross over.
Sure.
But there are definitely games that just aren't Xbox ready, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I think a lot of that, again, I think a lot of that has to do with the cultural differences between the US Xbox team and the Japanese PlayStation team.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and like if you look at the launch titles for the Xbox, you know, it's Call of Duty, Battlefield, Fighter Within, Assassin's Creed, Killer Instinct. So it's a different ecosystem, you know, like whereas the PlayStation 4, it's Assassin's Creed as well and Battlefield, but then it's like, you know, Knack.
Or Little Big Planet or what have you.
Angry Birds Star Wars.
Right.
Yeah. Which will come to the Xbox, sure, but that's what's considered a launch title for PS3. Mm-hmm. Whereas that's just
or PS4,
whatever. PS4, sorry. Whereas on the Xbox, that's just a title.
Right. And I'm glad that we live in a world where these ecosystems are different and they can coexist. Personally, I barely have time to play games these days, which is why I actually don't own a current console at all. And to be honest, I'm reticent to also pay over $1,000 for both consoles, which is what I would probably have to wind up doing in order to play the games that I truly want to play. There's always these first-party titles on one console that I desperately, desperately want to play. And so do you rent a console for a week, get your fill, and then bring it back? Or do you plop down $500, $600 for something that is mostly on, in my study anyway, going to go just collect dust?
Yeah, I totally understand. I mean, I will probably get a PS4. I have a PS3. I will look at the Xbox longingly, but, you know, I don't know.
Well, here's a question. Because the PS4, and because there's no backward compatibility, so you would keep your PS3 and your library of games.
I'll keep my PS3.
Right. So that's yet another thing that's going to be in front of your television or in your cabinet or whatever.
I was
going
to say, in my case, it's not a fair question because I have shelves full of consoles, so of course I'm going to keep my PS3.
Right.
So, will most people keep their PS3s? I don't know. It's the backwards compatibility thing is really, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Another thing I know about the PS3, PS4, it's like versus, you know, the market or the players for Xbox is like PS3, PS4 is for people who watch anime. Xbox is for people who don't.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much what it comes down to. Yeah, you will never see an anime-inspired title on Xbox. You know, there will be no Gundam, there will be no Dragon Ball, there will be no, you know, that's just not the Xbox milieu. You know, it's not the vibe of the Xbox.
Right.
You'll see different things, but it's definitely a more Western vibe. And that's cool. I like that. I like that there is this, you know, Eastern side and Western side, and you can kind of do both if you want to.
Right. And it's good for competition, too. I mean, they both want to dominate, but they do both want to put forth their vision. So it's good in both ways. It kind of drives, I mean, you know, it drives games that you wouldn't get on another console to exist. I mean, there are some things that are squishy, like Skylanders, mm-hmm. I can see on either console. But when I think of, you know, Call of Duty, I think of Xbox.
Right. I think of a lot of, you know, 10-year-olds yelling horrible, horrible things.
10-year-olds? 32-year-olds?
That too. Yeah, I think the overall design of the consoles is actually kind of nice. I think the Xbox actually reminds me of an old-school VCR. It looks like you want to, like, shove a tape into it, you know?
Well, it clearly is meant to fit into your home entertainment system area.
Whoa, is that a euphemism? What was going on there? Ironically, I just opened up the cabinet next to me, and in that cabinet is my old VCR, and it looks and the VCR, by the way, is a Sony VCR, and it looks remarkably like the Xbox. Obviously, instead of a little slot opening, there's the cassette opening, but other than that, the chamfered, downsloping front bezel, the very black, I mean, the X-Bone is a piano black type of thing, and this is much more of a, you know, sandblasted matte finish, but it's basically the same thing.
Well, they're both clearly meant to fit there, you know, under your TV and not stand out. Until, of course, the Star Wars version comes out and the Call of Duty version comes out.
It is, as I say, they are both very black consoles.
Yeah.
I actually kind of liked the 360. I like the fact that it was kind of a different shape, and it looked like a game box versus, I don't know, there's a genericness to the X-Bone that
you
know, it's, I like it, but I don't like it. It's weird. Yeah.
I think that genericness is meant to make, you know, the spouse happy, or to make, you know, everyone go, what is that? Oh, it's an Xbox. Okay.
Well, it's designed to be invisible, right? But if you if you're a high-end hi-fi person, you know, and you buy Macintosh receivers or amplifiers, or if you buy, you know, these super high-end pieces, component pieces, you know, they have an aesthetic to them. They're not like the lower tier AV equipment that you buy, where it's very generic looking and very kind of sad looking.
Right, but most people don't buy Macintosh amplifiers. And
but they should, because they're radically superior.
Well, yeah, but most people don't care. Yeah.
For those that don't know, it's Macintosh spelled correctly, unlike the Apple product.
Being Scot and Irish, I will agree with that.
Yes. Yes. No, if you Google Macintosh receivers or Macintosh amplifiers will probably give you better pictures. Definitely worth it. And they're meant to be looked at. They're pieces of art. You know, and this is, this to me looks like a plastic, you know, thing that you, in a lot of AV cabinets, they've got the acoustically transparent and IR transparent fabric, so that you don't actually see the components, but they will accept input from your remote control. You kind of want to put that stuff, the two consoles, back in there. You don't really want to see it.
Yeah, but what most people are going to have a TV sitting on a stand, and inside that stand is a Blu-ray player. Maybe there's a TiVo or a cable box, and maybe there's a receiver, maybe there's not. And this thing will fit in there, and it will be unobtrusive. It won't call attention to itself, and, you know. And in a way, that's what they kind of want this thing to become. I think all of them do. Maybe not so much Nintendo, because they live in a different world.
Well, they're different,
still.
Right.
Yeah, I don't even want to talk about Nintendo in the same breath as the other two, because it's a totally different thing.
Right, exactly. It's a totally different system. And, you know, and don't get me wrong, I love them as a company. You know, I had an original Famicom and Super Famicom. That would be a Nintendo and a Super Nintendo. I had these systems. I loved them. You know, I used to trade all sorts of games. It was a whole, you know, it was a super blast. And no one makes first-party titles like Nintendo.
Nuh-uh.
I mean, at all, full stop. And that's kind of the complaint, which is, oh, well, you know, they're really lagging behind. They should really just, you know, stop making hardware and stop producing software for, you know, the other companies' consoles. That's never going to happen.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, I just bought a 3DS.
Really?
Just to play Luigi's Mansion 2. I literally bought a system just to play one of their games. Yeah. That's how,
And you didn't go with the 2DS, the sort of the new one.
I got it before the 2DS came out. I would have gotten the 2DS because the 3DS is kind of small, and I didn't get the XL because I was being cheap. And
right.
But now I would have gotten the 2DS. Although sometimes the 3D stuff's kind of fun, but
neat.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. I literally bought a piece of their hardware just to play one of their titles.
Right. You know? Well, I mean, you had to.
The game is so good.
Well, yeah, exactly. Much like Apple builds products that delight you, or at least they did at one point in time.
Yeah, one point in time.
Yeah, I think Nintendo makes software that delights you. I mean, if you take a look at, you know, even the first Super Mario Brothers from, what, 86? People who actually remember this stuff will certainly kill me for not remembering. But anyway, the original Super Mario Brothers, you know, it was delightful to play. It taught you without telling you. You know, it just showed you how to play the game. And that was really compelling. These days, I think the entire concept of gaming has been changed to where, on one level, these games have become incredibly difficult and complex. But on another level, they've also become very, very easy. And how do you have both? Well, it seems to me that things that are puzzles have been dumbed down. They're not as difficult as they once were, because I think people have less time to play games. But I also think that there's just a difficulty level in games where, because of the limitations of the hardware of yesteryear, things were more difficult versus now, where because the hardware is better and because you can have more expansive worlds, software writers, game makers are less apt to put these impossible roadblocks in your way so that you can enjoy the game.
Right. In a way, they don't have to rely on puzzles as much as they did once. You know, when you can go chase actual things and it looks real and you're following it, and you know, that's one thing. And then there's the whole, like you said, the whole casual gamer thing thrown in too. It kind of changes things, but I think that's where Nintendo, and I think this is probably what you're getting at, is that's where Nintendo says, we're not finished there.
Right.
We still have stuff to do there. And they do. I mean,
well, the Wii proved that, right?
Yeah, the Super Mario was not a short-form game. It's not a casual game. If you want to finish that game, you've got to put some hours into it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, speedruns aside, where people have been doing it in like under 2.5 minutes or something ridiculous, it's a real game that requires real effort to play, and it requires thought. And, you know, anyone who's tried to play Ninja Gaiden, the original for the Nintendo.
Oh, my God.
You know, kids these days cannot beat that game because they've never
encountered... Chrono Trigger?
Oh, yeah. Because they've never encountered anything that difficult. And I think that's because, again, it's both Ninja Gaiden and, what was it, the original...
I don't know if never, but
yeah,
not as much. I mean, like, I played It'll Do on the Ouya, and that was it's a very Zelda kind of game, you know? It had a lot of puzzles in it.
Oh, yeah. But even games, even side-scrollers like the original Castlevania and the original Ninja Gaiden, you know, if you stood there and, you know, just waited for one of the creatures to pass you by, it would pass you by, but you had to back up. But if you backed up and then went forward again, it would re-trigger the creature. So you'd have to figure out how to time a particular jump. And that was because these creatures literally went in and out of memory.
Right.
Well,
yeah, or they really short case is for, you know, all right, if you're here and here, this is, you know, yeah. It's funny to you talking about Mario. I'm listening to Stephen Kent's The Ultimate History of Video Games.
Oh, right on.
And right now, just talking about when Donkey Kong comes to America.
Ooh, and, very nice. Yeah. Name change and all.
Yeah, and it struck me that, oh my God, that's the origin of Mario, and Mario is still a big deal.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That was I believe 1981 or 1982.
It was really early.
It was very, very early. And yeah, and Mario was there and I was there with him. I was so incredibly enthralled with that game. And throughout Mario's life cycle.
And a lot of people don't even know, have never seen the original Mario Brothers. I was talking to somebody where I'm like, you know, there was a game before Super Mario.
Yeah, there was no Super involved. It was just Mario Brothers. It involved flies, it involved crabs.
There were crabs.
There were crabs involved. and coins, lots of coins.
Lots and coins.
Yeah. And it was a great platformer. You could only go right or left. You had to jump in order to move to platforms. It was ostensibly Joust, but with people. Yeah. And it was, yeah, it was, you think about it that way, it was inverted joust. So instead of having to, you know, instead of having to land on top of this,
you're assuming they know what joust is.
Oh, God. Yeah, so Google Joust. It's a fantastic game, involves flying ostriches and jousting. I mean, whoever thought of that game was a total genius, and I should know who made that game because it's an historically gorgeous, fantastic game, but I don't. So that's what the Google's for. It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah, it's probably Bill Futzenreder, but I'm not sure. It was a Williams game, and yes, I'm totally a Williams
All nut. The Williams games All were the Williams so games. Good, so well thought out, and so much fun. I mean, yes, they were quarter munchers, meaning that they were specifically built to take your money. But
right, Eugene Jarvis as a human was built to take your money. He's a guy. Yeah. Oh God. He's yeah.
Yes.
Sorry. maybe we should have a Defender show.
Oh God, yes. Oh God, and we should bring back Kanan, and we should have the cars playing in the background.
Right.
That's a callback, boys and girls.
Well, and of course, this Donkey Kong was Miyamoto's first real game for them, and you know, and it was a breakout hit.
It was tremendous. It had everything you could possibly want in a game. It had a beautiful girl that you wanted to save. You had a little guy with a cool little thing, and you could jump, and it was a platformer, and you weren't completely passive. You know, you could grab the hammer, and that further limited you in what you could do. But you had the hammer,
right?
And you could
go on the offensive. Strategy: do you ignore the hammer or do you use the hammer?
Exactly.
Actually, they're talking about a bit of this now, where the games that are getting, once they got past a certain point where people could choose their strategy in playing, like they were talking about Defender. Some people choose to never pick up people.
Right.
Some people choose to let the landers pick up the person and then they just shoot them and kill them rather than let them turn to mutants. Some people go after all the people, you know. It's like, yeah. But prior to that, games, the goals were a bit more straightforward.
Well, that's just it. There were no goals. There was no end game. You just kept playing until you died.
Yeah, right. You shot all the... Well, that's especially true of, like, Space Invaders. It's like...
Well, right.
You don't realize that game has no end.
No. it has no
eventually
end.
You will lose.
Yeah. And all those early games, you know, were like that. All the quarter munchers were like that. A, you could never continue. B, everything would just get faster and faster and faster until you died. And those who were ninja enough to survive the incredibly fast stuff, you would keep going ad infinitum until, you know, the integer flipped over of the score or of the what have you.
Or you ended up on a kill screen.
Right, exactly. And that's what the kill screen was. The kill screen was buffer overflow. Yeah. Welcome to buffer overflow.
I wonder what was I know there probably were a game here or there that we're missing that did have an end, but I'm trying to think of what would be the first real... that modern arcade game that really had an ending to it.
Well, okay, so Super Mario Brothers was in fact an arcade game, and it was different from the home version of the game.
That's true, right?
And
right.
It did in fact have an ending. It always intrigued me because so there were several different versions of Super Mario Brothers, right? There was the Super Mario Brothers that was a cartridge that you could buy separately. It was not a bundle when the original Nintendo first came out. When the original Nintendo first came out, it came with a giant robot and
You could get a giant robot.
Well, right, yeah. It came with there was the bare bones package, and then there was the deluxe package. The deluxe package came with the light gun, and it came with Rob, the robotic operating buddy. And it came with two games. It came with Duck Hunt, and it came with Gyromite.
One of two games that worked with a robot.
Yes. And that's it. One of two. And then they also had a bunch of launch titles, Kung Fu being one of them, which was such an amazing Twitch game, Ice Climber, there were a couple of others as well, but Super Mario Brothers, actually, to be perfectly frank, I don't even remember Super Mario Brothers being a launch title. I think it was...
It wasn't a launch title.
The launch plus title.
But because their launch was so soft, really.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, because they were the first on the scene after the Atari incident. You know, once the Atari incident happened, which was basically, so back in the day, the Atari systems and the video game systems of the time completely saturated the market because there was no barrier to entry. Anyone who wanted to create a cartridge could create a cartridge, and a lot of them sucked. Nintendo came on the scene and they decided, you know what, if we're going to come on the scene, we're going to do this and we're going to do this differently, and we're going to create the Nintendo seal of approval, which basically meant that, okay, you could certainly make a cartridge for our system, but we have to approve it first. You have to give us lots of money and we have to approve it, and only then will we give you the decoder chip that will allow your cartridge to play on our system.
Yeah, it was the original Apple.
yeah. And so they did that. And so prior to that, Super Mario Brothers actually existed in the arcade as an entirely separate game. And then there was the PlayChoice 10 version, which was far more similar to the home Nintendo version. But
the PlayChoice actually used the regular carts, didn't they?
They used regular carts that were slightly modified, and they were slightly modified to work in the PlayChoice 10 system. So they had, so the PlayChoice 10 system was like a jukebox for video games. It had upwards of 10 cartridges, hence PlayChoice 10, and you could choose between games that they offered, and it was, you know, it was the contemporary games of the time. It was Super Mario Brothers, it was tennis, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Very often they were ganged together, so if you had a two-player game, you could have someone sit across from you and you could both play tennis simultaneously, so they would see their version, their perspective, and you would see your perspective, which was actually really, really amazing at the time. But it was also on a timer. You could play games as long as you wanted for 300 seconds or for 500 seconds or whatever.
Right.
And then you'd pop another quarter in. And so the cartridges were modified to allow for that, and you could pop another quarter in and get extra time. But the other version, there was the PlayChoice 10 version, the console version, and the true arcade one-off version, where it was just a standalone arcade, as if you would go to any other arcade on the planet and just play that one game. And those levels were entirely different. Well, I shouldn't say entirely.
Yeah, there were differences.
Yeah, they certainly mimicked each other, but there were a lot of cases that were totally different. I remember a world in the upright version, the arcade version, where you had to take a blind jump. You had this, you know, you had one of the oscillating beams, and you had to run as fast as you possibly could and then jump because you could not see anything on the screen.
It's like, and the only way to figure it out is either see someone else do it or sacrifice a man to figure out where it is
or
when you're falling.
Die all the time. Because here's the thing. The other beam was also oscillating. they do not give you a chance.
So I guess it was one of the quote-unquote launch titles, but it definitely wasn't bundled. There were 18 titles launched for the American, you know, American version at CES. I guess for the Famicom, like, it was Donkey Kong's all the way down. It was Donkey Kong Jr. and Popeye, which I also remember from the arcade.
Oh, yes. I had Popeye for the ColecoVision.
Funny story about Coleco.
Yes.
Yeah, so Coleco at the CES in 83, Coleco was showing Donkey Kong on their Coleco Atom.
On their Atom? Oh, interesting.
Which was totally not kosher with Atari, who had the American rights.
Well, because I had ColecoVision, I had Donkey Kong for ColecoVision.
Yeah, it existed. It was supposed to be licensed, but they weren't supposed to be showing it then.
Oh, I see. Because the Atom, okay, so backing up, the ColecoVision was a competitor in the same generation as the Atari 2600 and the Intellivision. The ColecoVision had, in my humble opinion, radically better graphics and sound, certainly than the 2600, and arguably better graphics and sound than the Intellivision. It had different games. It had these weird, crazy-ass paddles.
Yeah, those paddles were stupid.
I've always had big hands, so those worked really well for me. The paddles themselves had these little nub joysticks that you used with your entire right hand if you're right-handed, but you held the controller in your left hand. It had two buttons, one on the right side, one on the left side. And then it had a blister number pad on, on its base. So you had, you know, as if it were like a telephone, 1 through 9, 0, and a pound and a sharp. And a little slit was on the side of that. So you could actually place in an overlay, like a plastic overlay.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you were playing a game like Mousetrap, Mousetrap in the arcade had a crap ton of buttons to chain, to open and close the various colored doors, right? And the ColecoVision only had two buttons and the entire number pad. So you could put on one of these overlays and then you could actually use those blister buttons as other buttons for your game. Otherwise, they were used to dial in the type of game that you wanted to play. So each cartridge had one or more difficulty levels, and most cartridges had either a one-player or a two-player mode. So if you chose level 4, that was like the hardest difficulty, and you just, you know, click number 4, and then you'd be off. And that would raise the difficulty. Everything would be faster. You would be slower. You'd die way more. And it would be very, very, very sad. But the ColecoVision was also interesting because it had this port in the front of it. And that port allowed you to put on various peripherals. They had a trackball, so you could play Centipede and Millipede. Well, actually, you couldn't play Centipede and Millipede. You could play their clones because Atari owned it. Owned both Centipede and Millipede. But here's the crazy thing. They had an emulator. Actually, it wasn't an emulator at all. It was Atari 2600 hardware as a peripheral. So you could play Atari 2600 games on your ColecoVision natively. It was amazing. I had it.
I ran across an ad, like an old Sears catalog ad for that one not long ago, and it was just looking at it. It's just fascinating. Well, I mean, like the story I was telling about Coleco earlier about the whole Donkey Kong thing, that actually killed the deal that Nintendo was in negotiations. They were talking to Atari about releasing what ostensibly was the Famicom in North America under the Atari name.
Wow, I had no idea.
That whole thing soured the deal, and all just stuff just went to shit after that. Wow. But yeah, originally they were going to release the console, and so the NES would have been the Atari, and although it wasn't NES, it was Advanced Game System or something. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The Atari name for what would be the NES was the Advanced Gaming System. That's fascinating. I had no idea about that. But yeah, that was really amazing. So the Atom, so to follow this up, which is a total tangent, but to follow this up, the Atom was ColecoVision's computer. So personal computing was becoming huge at the time, the Apple IIe, the Apple IIc even, and to a lesser extent, you had IBM PCs. But the Apple IIe was kind of nearly ubiquitous in schools by that time. And so home computing was becoming a big thing. Oh, Texas Instruments 994A.
Right.
That was another, quote, computer, but it was also cartridge-based as opposed to disk-based. So the Atom was the ColecoVision foray, because a lot of folk were saying, oh, well, these video game people are creating computers. You know, Atari made their own computers for a while. So we need one of those, too. And the Atom, if I recall correctly, was yet another peripheral for your ColecoVision, and it took cassettes.
Yeah, and it was and a cassette player built in. I guess you could get a floppy drive, but yeah, it had a cassette player built in. It was weird.
Right, yeah. Remember, like, in the 1970s, where you're, or even earlier in movies and such, where they have, you know, the computer room and the computer is the entire building, and then you've got, you know, the blinky lights, and you've got these reel-to-reel metal, reel-to-reel machines and such, and they're going back and forth, and they're, you know, spinning and then pausing a little bit and then slowly rolling and then spinning in the other direction and doing that. That's exactly what the Atom did, except with an audio cassette.
But of course, the Atom also had to compete with the planet-killing Commodore 64.
Oh, right. That was the other big one. And again, the Commodore 64 was ostensibly a game system that they kind of added on to become more robust and more compute-like.
Yeah, I mean, it was also the successor to the VIC-20, which was, but...
Right.
Yeah.
But that was the big thing that, like, changed everything.
Right. These video game systems are now coming with microcontrollers or microprocessors, and it was where it started, the lines were starting to be blurred, and they were saying, hey, you can have a computer in your house now, you know?
Right, and that was the whole thing. Once you had BASIC on your home game console, you could do a whole variety of things. You could make your own games, and that was very appealing to a certain demographic, including the one I'm in.
Yeah, I mean, you had the Acorn was yep. out in the UK.
Exactly. And that was huge. Absolutely huge.
Yeah, the C64 was basically the Acorn of America at the time, I guess.
Right, which is interesting because the Amiga became such a huge hit in Europe and was never... Oh, yeah. You know, and the Amiga was the successor to the Commodore 128, and which was the successor to the 64, which was the successor to the VIC-20, as you mentioned. It's, oh my goodness.
But the Amiga, oh God, it was so much more. Oh.
Yeah, no, it was everything.
I still think so fondly of my Amiga 1000, but then again, I do have three Amigas.
Oh dear. So it's funny that we sort of went on this historic, nostalgic tangent based upon the new systems, because there's also a lot of really cool new games coming out as well. Not necessarily eventually they will be coming out for the consoles as well.
There's some cool old games coming out, too.
Well, that's just it. Yeah, it seems to be that there's a resurgence of all the old CD-ROM games, which is completely mad. So my stake on it is I was completely obsessed with Myst. When it came out,
yep.
I thought it was, I mean, you have no idea. I lost 3 whole days playing that game. I didn't sleep.
I absolutely have the same. I do have an idea because it was, yeah, I was the same. I'm like, Mom, I need a CD-ROM drive now.
Now. Yeah. Oh, my God. It was amazing because... It was for the Mac, and there were games out for the Macintosh. I mean, aside from Shufflepuck Cafe and, you know, various and sundry black and white games from 1984, gaming on the Mac was unheard of. And so here there is this small company called Cyan, and they've made a few games in the past, and they were pretty good games, but... They decided to go in a slightly different route. Actually, it was extraordinarily quite similar because their prior games were mostly based upon HyperCard, which was a sort of an interesting computing platform, for lack of a better term, or framework, I should say.
Yeah, it's really hard to describe. If you know HyperCard, you think of it as simple, but describing HyperCard is not that easy.
Yeah, I lost 3 days to Myst, and it was... entirely enthralling. It was built upon HyperCard, as was a lot of their previous games. In this version, they tweaked the hell out of HyperCard. No longer was it a black and white game. It was in color. It was using these crazy pre-rendered 3D graphics that you've never seen before in your entire life. The textures alone were phenomenal. And you also have to keep in mind that even though it was color, it was still 256 colors, but it was indexed and it had a shared palette, which meant that things looked really, really good for 256 colors. They weren't, you know, the standard system colors. They were a bespoke 256 colors.
Right.
Per screen.
Yeah. So Richard Watson, or aka Rawa from Cyan, he's got his old site is still online, and he talks about that, about using dithering and how they had to, you would basically paint the image with your 256 colors, but the problem is when you change the palette, you would get this flashing thing.
Right, which is how the old color cycling animations worked. You took a limited color palette, like a GIF or have you, and you would simply swap the colors and you could get this animation rainbow-like effect. And it's precisely what would happen when you change the color palette.
So, yeah, so what they wanted to do was to mitigate that. So, you know, they had, so because in order to make it look in order to make the 256 color things look as good as the 24-bit renders they did, you know, they would have to do this dithering, and they would have to use a selective palette for each frame. So what they would do, they decided they would make a palette for each age. And then they do that so that they could switch the palette. And it was just, it's fascinating in old school programming. We should put a link in the show notes to that. There's also some information about just making the games as well. So it's really interesting. He's still with Cyan, by the way. So it's kind of cool. He's working on the new game.
Right. And so there is a sort of spiritual successor to Myst coming out called Obduction with an O, which is a little bit weird, but, you know, I'll run with that.
It's Cyan, so it's, you know, it's got to be a little weird.
It's meant to be a little weird.
They always like playing, they play with language in everything they do, so.
That's true, yeah. And it promises to be as rich and a very similar experience to Myst. So Myst, again, was these glorious three-dimensional backgrounds with live-action quick times built into them. And this seems to be a similar thing where we've got live-action in the foreground with pre-rendered backgrounds. And I'm really looking forward to what they do with it, because it sounds to me like it's another type of game where you can't die. You know, you just explore and you discover. And those are the types of games that I always go back to.
Yeah, I don't know how much pre-rendering is really going to factor in, though, because reading some of the updates, it looks like it may be, like, totally immersive. So I don't know. I don't care. I want to play it.
Yeah, I'm really curious as to how it's going to be. Yeah, and I guess when I said pre-rendered backgrounds, I meant more along the lines of artificial backgrounds with live actors. You know, blue screened or green screened in through QuickTime or another video type mechanism.
Yeah, now that you can do just any damn thing you want.
Right, you just project something onto a, you know, two-dimensional polygon and you're good to go. Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. They are doing a Kickstarter. By the time this goes out, they will have done a Kickstarter. It will probably be funded, I imagine.
It's funded.
Oh, it has been funded. Oh, wonderful. Yes. I haven't received updates, so I was curious. Very, very cool. So, yeah, that's going to be really quite intriguing. They have a bunch of stretch goals as well and some really cool prizes.
I think, you know, and they sent out an update, and like the Kickstarter amount went down, you know, because people who didn't follow through or whatever, but it was really close. So I think we're going to get the Oculus Rift stretch goal.
Wow.
Which makes me want to buy an Oculus Rift.
Oh, wow. I've got a friend who's got one, and it's rather interesting. I would love to play with one. I haven't yet.
I would love to play a Cyan game.
Yes, and be fully immersed in that. I also want to play, someone created a version of Paperboy with a stationary bicycle and an Oculus Rift and a Kinect. It was pretty amazing.
Oh god, I used to love Paperboy.
Oh yeah. I was so bad at it, but it was so much fun to play. Oh god. So I'm very curious as to what Obduction. Yeah, I that and what is it, 720. I would play 720 for days. Both of those games were sort of somehow equal in my brain.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I would play 720 and it would just eat quarters all day, and I'd play Paperboy and it would eat quarters all day. I think because it had funny joysticks.
Yeah, the Paperboy had
had BMX handlebars.
Yeah, right.
And you could push forward and pull back, and you pulled back, and that's how you braked. You know, it would have the triggers to fly right or left. Yeah, you know, you could fly the newspaper at the houses, and then with 720, it had a joystick, except that the joystick was at an angle and it rotated 360 degrees. And so you could kind of spin yourself.
It's the name.
Yes. And so you can kind of spin yourself like you would, you know, if you were riding a skateboard. And it was a lot of fun. Yeah, so I'm very, so many rat holes. I'm very curious as to what Obduction is going to be all about. In a way, I'm very glad they were very hush-hush about the general plot, but I love the idea of, here's this very alien world, and here's this seemingly normal farmhouse in the middle of this incredibly alien world.
Rand said, you know, that's one of the things, like, that makes makes it so interesting and fun is, you know, to be plopped down in the middle, just like in Myst and Riven, and, you know, you're plopped down and you have to explore and learn where you are. So, yeah. I can't wait.
But, I mean, Laura, what do you think the lead time is? I mean, I can't imagine they'd be able to ship it by 2014.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, obviously it's going to take a while to make the game.
Right.
Because, I mean, they have, you know, started, they've got, they have some basic elements done, and they've done some design stuff. But, you know, the actual game, I mean, they're talking about, it's going to be at least 2 years.
Yeah,
I think October of 2015 is their goal.
Right, which I think is perfectly reasonable. Which brings me to the
whole,
you know, Kickstarter is for people who don't know what they're doing. You know, so it's not entirely true, but it certainly seems that the vast majority of Kickstarter projects that I've been a part of in some way, shape, or form, it always seems that they, which is a topic for another show entirely, but it always seems that they ask for too little money, and they are woefully underestimating the amount of time it's going to take to come to
right.
the market.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. One or both of those is always true.
Yeah, and whereas Abduction is different. You know, you have a bunch of people that they know what they're doing,
right?
And yeah. They know it's going to take 2 years.
They're veterans, you know? And they also, yeah, exactly. They know it's going to take a really long time, and they know exactly what it takes to pull off a truly top-notch game. You know, a true AAA title. Whereas, you know, sure, there are lots of other games involved, but their stakes are much lower.
Yeah, they're basically mitigating risk.
Right.
You know, it's like, we think there's enough people for this game, and we're going to find out by doing this Kickstarter. You're basically pre-buying the game, you know.
So in keeping with the let's kickstart new versions of old games, The Seventh Guest, which was
so
the
near
sort of
and
the
dear
missed,
to my heart.
The missed rival. I didn't like The Seventh Guest as
really?
Much. I mean, I liked it, but I didn't like it nearly as much as Myst.
All right, here's my Desert Island 3 CD-ROM titles, as they were known back in the day. It was Myst, Seventh Guest, and Grim Fandango.
Ooh,
I'm happy.
Ooh, yeah. So you were a Seventh Guest fan. I didn't like Seventh Guest.
I was a huge Seventh Guest fan.
I didn't like it because I thought that the graphics were far cheesier than Myst. So once you saw Myst, I couldn't go back to The Seventh Guest, even though it was full motion video, and, you know, you transitioned from one room to another via this, you know, beautiful albeit choppy, you know, video. There were a lot of bits that were very compelling or theoretically compelling that I just wasn't feeling once I was immersed in Myst.
Well, okay. I don't know. I really enjoyed the story. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't as beautiful as Myst, but Myst, again, it's a static image, and then you turn, new static image. I'm like a total haunted house kind of person.
Well,
too.
That's the whole thing. Seventh Guest was a really amazing ghost story.
Mm.
You know, it was basically an interactive ghost story. You learnt about the characters, you learnt about, and I'm not going to spoil the game because there's a very lovely twist ending. But,
and you can get it and play it now on your devices.
You yeah, it's available on iOS. And the same thing with Myst as well. Actually, both flavors of Myst. So there was the original Myst, and then there was the sequel called Riven. Actually, it was called Riven, a sequel to Myst. and then eventually what they did was they created what they call Real Myst, which was a fully 3D rendered, walkable version of Myst, which I hated.
Yeah, it wasn't the same. And I mean, they weren't real crazy about it, to be honest. But,
right.
You know, but people did ask for it.
People asked for it desperately because of The Seventh Guest. They saw that you could have these sort of immersive experiences now with the full motion video. And this kind of went one step further, where you could actually control your person, and you could, you know, go and walk about and reach areas that you couldn't necessarily otherwise reach, which was very cool. And it also added an additional age. So fans of the original, you know, if they weren't super keen on buying it or they were kind of on the fence, well, if they bought it, then they would be rewarded with another age, which was really cool.
Right. And, you know, and it was also, when it came around, it was during a time where full 3D environments were not unheard of, you know, they were...
Right, they were viable at the time.
Right.
Yeah, it seemed to me to be, and not, I mean, cashing in sounds really harsh, and I don't mean it quite that harshly.
Well, you wouldn't be the first one to say that. I mean, I think even some of the cyan people have said, you know, that it was kind of that in a way. It, not necessarily cashing in, but... That there was, people said, hey, we want this. And they were like, okay, well, okay. Right.
Yeah, it really was giving the fan base what they were looking for. But it's, yeah, you know, in the true curse of that, right? You know, be careful of what
give
you wish
what you
for.
Ask for, right? Right.
In the true curse of that, they came out with something that was less elegant. And in a weird way, less immersive. Even though, yeah, you know, you were able to... walk in the environment, it was fiddly. You know, you could get stuck in places and...
Yeah, there was a certain element of the gameplay was being presented with things in a certain way, you know, to draw your eye to things.
Right. It was a very controlled visual experience.
Right.
And you didn't have that when you were able to sort of freely roam about.
Right, right. You're probably more prone to miss things. The rocket, you know, there's all those switches you've got to find and stuff.
Oh, God. Yeah. All of the switches.
All of the switches.
I'm actually playing Myst again on my iPhone.
Yeah. I started playing it again on my, I put it on my Air, of all things.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, it's great. I should mention, I got it from, do you ever go to GOG.com?
Oh, GOG. Yeah.
Yeah. So GOG at one point had like a buy them all. And I bought them all.
And lo,
but
you
that
purchased
said,
all of the games.
Even so, they're only like $6, except for, I think, Uru and 5 or more. But for the most part, they're $6 to $10 for, you know, them. Oh, and you can get Manhole now. You were talking about one of the older games that they did. They redid Manhole.
So, nice.
That's kind of fun. I mean, it's a kid's game, but, you know, still.
Sure, but
into that thing.
Yeah, it's a very, but it's a classic historical game.
Right. If you're a Cyanite, you want to play this game.
If you're a Cyanite, right? I like that. It's better than Cylon, I suppose. Cylon was already taken.
But that's, in a way, I mean, there was a huge fan base for this game, so much so, you know, that they're still around.
Oh, yeah. No, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, there are websites to this day that are still dedicated to the lore of Myst.
Right. And Uru, they, you know, Uru Live, they've maintained the code.
Yeah. And while they don't have servers running anymore, there are servers running. You know, there are fan servers running, which is utterly fascinating. I never did that. I was never a part of that. But now that I know a little bit more about it, I'd be interested to check out. Although I imagine with no one else playing the game, that there would be little purpose to it.
Something tells me there'll probably be some more people playing again, but I don't know. I'm just happy to know it exists.
Yeah, right. It's, you know, it's one of those things that has been saved from the bit bucket.
Right, and to that same thing, you know, when Trilobite started re-releasing stuff, you know, The Seventh Guest, and they released one of the games separately and so forth, you know, that really was like, to me, it just, I mean, that is nostalgia, but I went back and played Seventh Guest again, and I'm like, oh my God, I love this game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm so excited for, I hope they get funded for this third game.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun. The one thing about Seventh Guest I really liked was the ghost story aspect. I thought the puzzles were kind of a little bit gimmicky, but in general, I loved the storytelling aspect. I thought that was really, really well done. You know, back in that day, you overlooked the cheesy green screening and the kind of the overacting. I mean,
sure,
it was almost the fun part of it. You know, it was very similar to when talkies first came about. You know, there's
right.
a lot of sort of overacting and over articulating and such.
Well, and this little studio basically said, you know what? We can probably shove some video in here. Let's just go do it. You know, and they hired actors and shot the stuff themselves and, you know, built their own green screen and
Yeah, and then just did it that way, you know. And now we're in an age where, you know, anyone, if they chose to do that, could do that in their living room, which is amazing, you know, right. Given enough time and effort, you know, which is really, really cool. So I am looking forward to the third version of, I have no idea what they're going to call it, because you have the seventh guest, you have 11th hour, and do we know what the third one's going to be called?
Yes, it's called The Collector, Seventh Guest, The Collector.
Okay, so they're calling it The Seventh Guest, The Collector, okay.
Right.
Yeah, I was wondering, it's like, well, where are they going to go with the 11th hour?
I think they didn't go, and my theory on that is there's a group of fans who were building their own game in that universe, which was going to be called The 13th Doll.
Oh.
And it's fairly well known within the, you know, the Seventh Guest fan base. So my guess is that, A, they want to keep the Seventh Guest name, you know, recognition.
Sure, sure.
And maybe avoid that whole thing with the 13th Doll.
The 13th Doll, yeah. Right. Yeah, I can see, again, because, you know, we have a generation of people who have never played Myst or Seventh Guest. So if they're going to come out with a new game, you know, what's their market? Is it us, you know, the people who have already played that game? Or is it, you know, are they trying to go for a new audience as well? But the problem with the new audience is that they don't know the history. So you kind of have to incorporate, either it is a true sequel and therefore you do incorporate the old name, the original name somewhere, or right. You kind of go tangentially where, like the Cyan folk did, where it's a spiritual successor to Myst. It's not right. Myst, it doesn't take place in the Myst universe, but it's a similar concept of, you know, you the protagonist, are never seen, you are there, it's first person, you're plopped down, you are Tabula Rasa, and you have to figure everything out. And that's lovely. I mean, I love those games. Those are absolutely fun to play. And they're also replayable as well. There are always those little nuances that you don't quite get the first time around.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. Replaying this. And like I said, the Seventh Guest is, you know, it's available on iOS and other things. And I think it's sold fairly well. So there may be, and it's definitely, it's a sequel. So I think that, yeah, retaining the name makes sense there.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to all of them. I wish them all the best. I'm very curious as to how they're going to turn out. And it's also interesting to me that Trilobite still exists.
Yeah, Trilobite still exists. They re-exist, I guess, in a way. Morphed and changed hands a bit, but I think Rob's always been there. And then when they started re-releasing the stuff, and I guess at some point he got the name back. I don't know the whole story there, but yeah, they definitely still exist as a company. I've talked to Charlie McHenry a couple times. He's a new guy with them, but they're really serious.
Right on. Very, very cool.
Oh, and a cool thing was, you know, one of the great things about Seventh Guest, the atmospheric part, was the Fat Man's music.
Oh, certainly.
It was so important to that game. And so they recently...
And he's back.
They inked a deal. He's going to, you know, he's giving them full access to his music to reuse. They have a new composer, but he has access to all the old music now, which is awesome. I have an interview with George Sanger somewhere that I really need to edit one day and release. He's a wonderful, wonderful, crazy person.
I think you mentioned him on a prior episode. Mm. And yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And so yes, you do have to edit that and bring it out.
Yep, one of these days.
Because it should be a lot of fun.
So do you have anything you want to pimp?
I do, actually. Well, I'm not really pimping necessarily, but it's something I found absolutely fascinating. Aside from the, you know, speaking of the HTML5 sex that is Polygon's Xbox One and PS4 coverage, National Geographic Channel actually recently came out with their Kennedy assassination film or special feature on television, and they made a companion website, and you can go to it at kennedyandoswald.com. And it is truly next level web material.
Wow.
Yeah. Mostly web pages, you know, you go to them, you're sort of laser hunting for information, you skim the information, and you're out. You know, and you're out measured in seconds, maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes. But in general, you're not poring over everything on a particular site. This is an experience. This is a novel. And you really do need to carve out about an hour or more of time to truly go through everything on this particular mini site. And by mini, I mean maxi. It is absolutely huge. It's cutting edge. If you are not using a modern browser, you will not have a good time. You can view this on iOS as well, although you really want to be on a desktop, so the screen is super large. They use a tremendous amount of HTML5 CSS animation. They incorporate video, they incorporate audio, they incorporate mouse-based parallax, all this cutting-edge material to further the Killing Kennedy story. And it's just absolutely phenomenal. I highly suggest checking it out. It's kennedyandoswald.com. It is, again, it is phenomenal. And I believe, I don't know for a fact, but I believe it was a company in Boston that did it for them, a studio in Boston that did it for them. So congrats to the folk out there. You did some really great work. And what about you? Do you have anything interesting to share with the class?
Yes, I do. I mentioned it earlier, I'm listening to The Ultimate History of Video Games.
Yes.
From Pong to Pokemon and Beyond by Stephen Kent. It's a really good primer on the history of video games. There are lots of books, and he even talks about, you know, this in the intro. But if you either are of a certain age and like to learn more about the video game industry as it grew up and you grew up with you, or if you're not of a certain age and you're interested in the history of video games, it's a really interesting book. It deep dives into Atari. And, you know, and maybe some people will be a little bit, you know, like, oh, that's a lot of Atari. But Atari was the ignition point.
Sure.
Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting stuff about, you know, various games. And then it moves on to Miyamoto and Nintendo. But it's really good. And you can get it, the book, or you can get it on Amazon. You can get it as ebooks. So it's not real expensive. It's not real long. So, but it's a really good book if you want to learn a bit about the history of video games.
Oh, cool. That the book sounds absolutely amazing. Are you reading it in an e-format or Dead Tree Edition?
I am listening to it from Audible.
Oh, that's very intriguing.
Yeah, I basically, everything I do now with my phone is basically either text, Trello, and listening to audiobooks. I just listen to audiobooks. I just finished The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which is like seven files that are 8 hours each.
Oof.
It's such a great. Anyway, that's a rat hole. We don't need to get in here.
My whole thing, I mean, I love the idea of an audiobook, but I refuse to have an abridged version of an audiobook.
Oh, I never buy abridged.
Right.
Yeah.
So that means that here you are listening to someone speak for, you know, 36 hours for like a 600-page novel.
Yeah.
And
Rise and Fall is an enormous book, as you can tell. Yeah, but
right.
I mean, you know. But my problem is I don't have time to read, and I have this stack of books, you know, and I just said, all right, sadly, it means that a lot of podcasts have been cut out of my life, but I am getting my reading done, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, well, as it were, and by reading, we mean listening.
I'm getting the books gone through.
There we
in
are.
One form or for another.
Yeah. So where can we find you?
Anyone can find me.
I can find you in different places. But all of
well,
you
have my phone number,
listeners,
so.
Yes.
You can find me on Twitter at TANKGRRL, or better yet, at about.me/Maggie McPhee, and the lovely and brilliant about.me. And where can we find you?
You can find me slaving away at my desk because I am working far too often and far too much. But you can also find me on the Twitters at Octothorpe, OCTOTHORPE. You can also find me at about.me/Octothorpe. And hey, that's all for now. You know what? You can also find me on the G+, on the G-Paws, as the kids say.
You know, I've been considering really getting back into G+, and I am all but convinced it's time for me to delete my Facebook account again.
I dig the G-Paws. I dig the G-Paws because I like how it can set up varying privacy circles and such.
Right, right.
Because I'm still technically a live journaler. I just don't post nearly as often as I once did. But I still maintain a huge group of friends there, and you know, I've known them for now for over a decade. And still read them, I just don't post very often. But one of the things that was very compelling to about LiveJournal was the ability to set various groups that had visibility. So you could change the privacy settings. You could say, okay, everyone on the internet can see this, or only LiveJournal members can see this, or only people on your friends list, or only a certain subset of the people on your friends list can see right. it. And that was really powerful when you had something that you wanted to talk about to these people who were your friends. You may not have met them in person, but they are your friends. You know, you can, you know, shape the visibility to only go to those core people that you actually trust. You know, if you wanted to talk about something kind of heavy, like, you
right.
know,
it was part of the posting process was you're in your head. Who's the audience for
yeah.
this? And then it's part of when you're ready to post, you'd have to decide that.
Right.
Yeah.
And GPAWS has some, you know, similar characteristics where, you know, you create these circles and you can target those circles to be able to see it. Now, it's not quite as bulletproof as LiveJournal, because if you show something to anyone, they could theoretically reshare it. They tell you, hey, this was set to a limited, you know, number of people, maybe you shouldn't reshare it, but they can't actually prevent you from, they don't actually prevent you straight up from sharing it, which
right.
is a bit of a problem. So kids, if you think you're just talking to your friends, that may be true, but your friends can screw you in the end. And so don't reveal anything on the GPAWS that you wouldn't otherwise, you know, want to be out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we're, like you mentioned way earlier in the show, you know, it's like we're so plugged into Google already.
Right.
That, you know, that's why I'm so problematic with Facebook. Facebook is twice removed from my life, really. You know, I really keep up with a couple people there, or two or three people, and that's about it. I don't go there because I want to be there. I go there because I care about some people who use it as to communicate with. So, yeah. Anyway, and you know, the kids are starting to hate on the Facebook, so time to move on.
I'm okay with that. That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out.
I guess this won't go out in time, but if anybody has any 8-bit Ataris, I'm in the market to buy some more. I think I'm gonna get it's just rat hole. I mean, I have a XCGS and I have a 5200, but I was thinking of getting 800 XL, but I'm like, well, that just basically does the same thing as the XGS. So I've never had like an ST from Atari ST. So I'm thinking of getting either a 520 or getting a 1040 and then putting the 520 ROMs back in it. The 1040 has a great keyboard, but it has shitty ROMs. But anyway, neither here nor there. I do own Amigas.
I'm curious though. So what do you plan on doing with the Atari machines, or just to have them for sort of historical purposes?
I need to send you a picture of what my bedroom looks like.
I've seen your bedroom. That sounds weird.
You haven't really seen
my bedroom. No, but I put my coat there and I saw into the bedroom. You put my coat in there and I grabbed it.
pulled out some consoles and got some new stuff so I've got a lot of consoles in my bedroom. Oh dear. Now.
You and Syracuse should not get together. It would be bad.
We do, actually.
Oh, I know.
But not around video games.
Oh god, no.
So yeah, I'm basically a 10-year-old boy.
One of you is the keymaster and one of you is the gatekeeper. And I think keeping you separated is probably a good idea. Because together, I think you have enough ancient technology to possibly bring about Armageddon.
So I want an ST to put in my collection.
Right on.